On the program today, we've got video games and teenagers and their video screens. Those are two separate stories. Also, Uber making its case as an economic asset. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the third day of November. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Gaming is our point of entry into the global economy today. Not gaming as in gambling, but gaming as in games, video games to be precise. Activision, the maker of the monster hit Call of Duty, among others, is buying King Digital, the maker of the mobile game Candy Crush. The price tag? Well, it's free. But if they want extra lives or to level up, they're going to have to pay. See what I did there? Little inside gamer joke. All right, just kidding. The real tally, it wasn't bad. The real tally is almost $6 billion, which is, of course, a boatload of cash. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson unlocks the value proposition for Activision.
Candy Crush is sugary sweet and pretty simple.
Tasty.
It's basically a matching game played primarily on a mobile device by hundreds of millions of people worldwide. Call of Duty, on the other hand, is a far more complex series of combat games for PCs and consoles. Different games, different players.
We don't, as a company, have a lot of female members in our audiences.
Bobby Kotick is CEO of Activision. He says, in addition to being a fan,
I love Candy Crush, and I'm not kidding.
He's also buying King Digital's mobile expertise.
Making games for mobile platforms is much more complicated than it would appear, and something that we tried and realized was not exactly in our wheelhouse.
It's a very different skill set, says Michael Pachter with Wedbush Securities. Mobile games are meant to be played waiting in line at Starbucks.
It's sort of like saying, why doesn't James Cameron make reality TV shows, and why doesn't Simon Cowell direct the next Avatar?
And this year, consumers are set to spend $32 billion on mobile and tablet games worldwide, says Dan Cryan. He's with the market research firm IHS.
It's been very rapidly growing, and it's set to continue to grow very nicely. Gaming has moved a long way beyond the sort of stereotypical hardcore gamer and has now become an activity for everyone.
But Cryan cautions this acquisition isn't without risk. He says it can be hard for mobile gaming companies to carry their audience from one game to the next. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
TransCanada, the Canadian oil and gas company behind the Keystone XL pipeline, has asked the Obama administration to suspend its review of that project. The administration, though, said today, not so fast, and that the White House will rule on the pipeline before the end of the Obama presidency. This morning, our own Scott Tong wrote up his six myths about Keystone, including, at least this is good for the climate.
Slow down. Oil sands is, according to one scientific study, about 20% dirtier than conventional oil. Here's the thing. The world's running out of conventional oil. Increasingly, all that's left is the unconventional, quote, dirtier stuff. So we have arrived at kind of a fossil fuel ugly contest at this point.
Go to marketplace.org to read the rest of Scott's six myths about Keystone. It is actually a pretty good Keystone explainer, truth be told. Oil, by the way, closed up about 4% today. Wall Street, not quite as much. Details, numbers, you know the drill. David Plouffe made his name as a political strategist. He's the guy who ran then-Senator Obama's 2008 campaign for the White House, and you know how that turned out. Plouffe, meanwhile, has turned to the politics of business. He's been at Uber for a little bit more than a year now, and he was back in Washington today for a speech laying out how Uber figures it's helping the economy, not just helping the rest of us get from point A to point B. David, thanks so much for coming on.
Great to be with you, Kai.
Why feel the need to make this speech right now?
Well, I think we have not, in a really holistic way, lifted up the hood, so to speak, and talked about the economic activity that we're seeing on the Uber platform. You know, half our drivers drive less than 10 hours a week to supplement income. If they get into a jam, it's a quick way to spin up some income. So we thought it was very important just to lift up the hood a little bit, share some of our data, and talk about how people are using the platform, not so much to get around town, but how to improve their economic situation.
Are you trying to legitimize the gig economy? Is that the deal here?
Well, no. I mean, first of all, we can't speak for the gig economy, the on-demand economy. I can only speak
for... Well, all right. Now, wait. Hold on. Because you guys basically created the gig economy.
Well, I think we're on the leading edge of it, sure. And there's a lot of different platforms out there, a lot of different models. But obviously, I can only speak authoritatively about ours. But I do think, listen, this desire for flexibility has been a chief goal of U.S. policymakers, certainly for decades. And it's been a chief desire of people for a very long time. There's a big debate now about, so-called on-call scheduling. Mm-hmm. The thing about Uber and most of these platforms is there's no schedule at all. And that sense of control where you fit this around everything else in your life is pretty powerful.
Yeah, but it comes with some costs, right? I mean, it comes without benefits. It comes without 401ks. It comes without a lot of the stuff that we as a workforce, quite honestly, have come to rely on and need in this society today.
Well, first of all, I think if you look at most of our drivers, most of them are having, they have other sources of income, either they or their spouse. Many of those jobs are providing benefits. Some people are going to drive with us for a very long time. Many don't. We have a lot of people come on the platform for 6 months or a year. We all have a huge spike in drivers heading into the holidays. And so when you think about wage stagnation, when you think about underemployment, that's where these platforms come in, when you give people the ability, the easy ability to spin up money very, very quickly.
Well, yeah, they're spinning up money, but they're working extra hours for the money. I mean, somebody's working 40 hours a week and then he drives for you guys for, I don't know, 10. You know, it's not like he's getting the money for nothing.
Well, sure, but that's a choice that they're making. I know from my political life, I've consumed a lot of political research mm-hmm. over the last decade. And again, most people say they don't have enough time or money and they're closely connected. So this is available for people.
You know, I appreciate that your job is to present Uber in the best light possible, right? And to lay out what you and the board at Uber feel are the value adds that you guys have for the American economy. I wonder, though, why it's so hard for people like you and others in your position to say, you know what? This economy is changing. Jobs are changing. Get over it. We're doing the best we can, but come on.
Well, again, my view is, and you know, I'm not an economist. I've certainly been in meetings with a lot of them through my career. There's a huge marketplace out there for people to make additional income when it's flexible. There's no question about that. Where does this go in the years to come? Are you going to have more and more people saying, you know what, I'm not going to have any traditional employment at all, and I'm just going to piece together freelancing? I don't see that happening overnight, but it's something we need to study carefully.
We should be clear here that your company doesn't survive unless the economy continues to develop in the way that you foresee, with increasing number of freelancers and temporary employees.
Well, what's interesting is I don't think that, you know, the economy has recovered statistically, from an unemployment standpoint, certainly in the market. When you talk to the average American, they're feeling a little bit more secure about the job they have, but they haven't had the pay raise they would have liked, obviously. And in many cases, they may not be getting the hours they'd like. So the Uber platform technology is now making it easier for people to add to their income. So I think that, in the go-go 90s, you had many, many Americans throughout that decade who, if it was easy for them to make a little bit of money, they would have chosen to do so. And so I think that those conditions, I think, no matter what happens in the economy from a macroeconomic standpoint, will continue.
David Plouffe used to work in the White House. Now he works at Uber, chief advisor and member of the board of directors there. David, thanks very much for your time.
Kai, thanks for having us.
There's a report out today that says the average American teenager spends about 9 hours a day on entertainment media. That is screen time on TVs, phones, tablets, and computers. And, by the way, does not include screen time spent at school. There is, as we all know, plenty of research out there showing that much time in front of a screen can be bad for kids. You know who it can be very, very good for, though? Businesses trying to tap into the oh-so-lucrative teen market. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams takes it from there.
So you know the stereotype about teenagers constantly being on their phones? Well, it's kind of true.
Teens spend far more time with media and technology than they do in school or with their parents or even sleeping.
James Steyer is the CEO of Common Sense Media, which did the survey. He and child psychologists are worried about all that exposure to commercial content. Companies argue they are reaching their customers where they are.
The fact is that this amount of time is going to be spent on their screens, probably regardless of what brands do.
Mary Lee Bliss is with Y-Pulse, a market research firm focused on teens and millennials. The survey also found that many of teens' media hours are spent multitasking, like doing homework while Snapchatting.
They're very adept at looking at multiple screens and multiple kinds of media at once. So it's not necessarily a negative. It's actually an opportunity for you to play into that behavior.
By doing things like promoting interactions with TV shows on social media. But that opportunity comes with a cost, says Professor Mara Einstein of Queens College in New York.
That constant moving from focusing on one piece of content to focusing on another piece of content doesn't give you the same sort of depth of understanding that you would get if you just focused on one thing at a time.
Whether that thing is an ad or a homework assignment. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Today in Man Bites Dog News, this item, Amazon has opened a brick-and-mortar bookstore, a real old-fashioned store in Seattle's University Village, right next to a Banana Republic, as it happens. It's the company's first actual store, needless to say. And you know, when Amazon really got going, a lot of people in the publishing industry thought it was the end of the road for the non-digital bookstore. But as Marketplace's Sally Herships reports, this story is not over yet.
Head to the main drag in Windsor Terrace, Brooklyn, and right between a real estate agent and a nail salon, you'll find a small community bookstore. It's almost like spotting a dodo or a carrier pigeon.
A lot of times people walk by and you'll see them stop in front of the shop, turn around, and they'll say, oh my gosh, there's a real bookstore here.
Terrace Books. Nick Rochella is the manager. But wasn't Amazon going to destroy all bookstores? And if it didn't, ebooks would? Tell me what, looking around the bookstore, what is on your shelves? Are your shelves full of Nooks and Kindles?
We have absolutely no electronic reading devices here.
How is that possible? Towards the back of the store, browsing old-fashioned paper books is one of the reasons. Jason Blumberg. He says he needs a book to read while visiting his parents. Do you do any book shopping online?
Yes.
Was that a guilty look towards the front of the store?
Yeah, I didn't want him to hear that. But, you know, I come here too.
Contrary to expectations, ebooks have not yet killed print.
I think a lot of people got caught up with the triple-digit growth in the ebook market in the first few years.
Tom Allen is president and CEO of the Association of American Publishers. He says ebooks make up only about 20% of the books consumers read. Do the math. Print books are still going strong.
The important thing is that publishers are agnostic about how people, you know, read their material, their content.
Moral of the story, publishers will provide readers with whatever format they want. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Basically show the individuals as they come off the bus. This is what you can do with a turnip. 50 ways to cook a chicken.
Recipe help free with your bus pass. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 89 points today, about a half percent, closed at 17,918. The NASDAQ up 17 points, a third percent, 5145. The S&P 500 rose 5 points, about a quarter percent, ended things at 2109. We told you about the corporate news of the day, Activision Blizzard buying King Digital Entertainment. Shares in ticker symbol KING. No points for originality there. Up nearly 15%. Traders bid up Activision shares more than 3%. On the theory that a rising tide lifts all boats, shares in Zynga, the company behind Farmville, up 3.6%. Avis says last quarter was worse than investors expected. The rental car company blamed the strong dollar as well. Shares in ticker symbol CAR, hello, down 11%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The United States Department of Agriculture defines a food desert as a low-income area with limited access to a grocery store and healthy foods. The USDA estimates as many as 18 million people in this country live in one, and a lot of the time and money spent fighting food deserts has been spent on getting grocery stores and farm stands out into neighborhoods. But they're trying a new approach in Ohio, putting fruits and vegetables right in the middle of town at the bus depot. Lewis Wallace of WYSO took a ride in Dayton, Ohio. Check that out.
I'm on a bus on the northwest side of Dayton, about 7 miles from downtown. As we head into town, we pass a grocery store a grand total of one time. a Kroger pretty far out near the end of the line. Otherwise, it's liquor stores, dollar stores, and not much else. Then I get into the downtown Dayton transportation hub. Inside, it's sort of cafeteria style with a golden fish and chicken, a burger place. But nearby is a farm stand set up right on the linoleum floor of the bus station. Carrots, potatoes, cabbages are overflowing from wooden bins. Judy Lewis is filling up a brown paper bag with spinach and broccoli.
And I just mix them up and make my own little salad for lunch at work.
She's a cosmetologist, and her makeup matches her purple sweater.
Oh, yeah, I love doing hair. It's my thing, you know. I love making people beautiful and making them happy, so.
She works inside a Walmart and comes through the bus hub on her way. She was excited when she learned there would be a fruit and vegetable stand here.
I was watching the news, and they mentioned this, and I said, well, it's about time.
Judy Lewis uses an EBT card, that's food stamps, which means for her, everything here is two for one. County Commissioner Judy Dodge says much of Dayton is considered a food desert.
There are so many people that cannot get fresh fruits and vegetables because they don't have good access to grocery stores.
And she's on a public health committee that thought,
wouldn't it be a great idea to put something downtown locally, close to the bus stops, so that people can come in, grab some fresh fruits and vegetables, get back on the bus, go back to work, or go home.
This is a pretty novel idea for a smaller city. Atlanta's transportation system has something similar, but you normally don't see a bus stop farm stand outside of places like New York and LA, and those are usually privately run. This one's a partnership between the bus system, the county, and a homeless services organization. April Easterling is on her way out of the market. I had noticed her waiting for the market to open.
Yes. I had to give me some grapes and bananas and tomato. I just was waiting. I've been waiting for it to come.
And before it was here, where would you shop for produce?
I didn't.
What April Easterling says, that she didn't shop for produce before, is interesting, because a new study on food deserts from the nonprofit National Bureau of Economic Research found that changes in access, more grocery stores, don't necessarily change people's shopping habits. In other words, a farm stand at the bus stop won't magically make lots more people buy veggies. Largely, it's a convenience for people like Judy Lewis, the cosmetologist, who was going to buy veggies somewhere anyhow. Commissioner Judy Dodge says she's aware of that, and so to encourage people to buy and cook the food, they'll also offer cooking and nutrition classes.
So we are prepared for that and to basically show the individuals as they come off the bus, this is what you can do with a turnip, 50 ways to cook a chicken, things like that. You know, this isn't going to solve all the problems for everyone, but, you know, at least it's a step.
Next step, making sure the store breaks even. In Dayton, Ohio, I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
We talk about China on this program quite a bit. We've got a guy there. It is the world's second biggest economy, after all. It makes sense. But things are slowing down because what the leadership in Beijing is trying to do is hard. They're trying to turn an economy based on building things into one that is based on consumers buying things. And that being China, the scale of change is huge, as is the collateral damage. Last month, one of the country's biggest coal mining companies said it's going to be laying off 100,000 people, all in one fell swoop. Our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, heard the news, got on the road to Qitaihe up in northeast China to talk to the people on the losing end of China's big economic transition.
Behind the doors of this gritty coal town, nobody answers.
Hey.
When they hear me say I'm a foreign journalist, most keep their doors shut. A woman opens hers, shoos me inside, and explains why.
We don't dare talk about what's happened. You talk and they'll retaliate.
They are local officials and managers at the Eastern Wind coal mine across the street. The mine is run by Longmei, the largest state-owned coal mining company in China's northeast. It's one of several mines here in the city of Qitaihe that will empty when Longmei lays off 100,000 workers later this autumn. The woman, who's too scared to give her name, says her 50-year-old husband will be one of them.
We are ordinary people, and now we can no longer get by. You have to allow us to live. Where are you going to put us? The government is cracking down on corruption, but it's all for nothing. The rich get richer, and the rest of us lose our jobs and simply can't survive.
Next door, a vendor named Song sells vegetables to the families of miners. Song's husband is a miner, too. He'll soon be out of work.
Once he's laid off, we'll get modest living expense payments for 3 years. After that, they claim they'll offer him job training. But come on, train him to do what? What can they possibly train him to do? Coal mining is all he knows.
Mining makes up nearly a quarter of Qitaihe's economy. Most of the city's 800,000 people work to support the city's coal mines. Longmei runs 12 mines here. Several will be shut down as the company lays off 40% of its entire workforce.
This is all related to corruption. The whole Communist Party is corrupt. The entire system. They do whatever they want. We could all die on the street and it's no business of theirs.
4 years ago, Longmei made more than $100 million in profit, but now this region has the slowest economic growth in China, and lower coal prices have plunged the company into hundreds of millions of dollars worth of debt. Corruption also played a part. A few years ago, a company vice president was charged with accepting $50 million worth in bribes, money he used to buy dozens of sports cars and 58 houses, several of which he had never even visited. A scene of the Longmei official sobbing at his corruption trial was the highlight of a government educational video warning officials of how not to conduct business in today's China. But for Longmei and for the city of Qitaihe, time is running out. Deng Xuan, an analyst of China's coal industry at ICIS C1 Energy, says he's never seen a coal company lay off so many people at once. And he says it's not just Longmei. He lists several other mining companies with a total of more than 600,000 workers that will likely end up bankrupt.
This situation is precisely what the government fears the most. A lot of idle men in their prime working age without jobs. It threatens to cause social unrest.
In April, several thousand Longmei workers already brought downtown Qitaihe to a halt because they hadn't been paid in months. Zhang Yong hasn't been paid either. Longmei owes the 52-year-old 2 months of salary, and yet every morning he arrives at the mine and is taken a mile underneath the ground to work a 10-hour shift, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, not a single day of rest. If you ask for a day off, he says, they'll find a worker to replace you. There are plenty of them now. Zhang lives inside an abandoned church. He's a caretaker here when he isn't in the mine.
Every Sunday, this church used to be full. There wasn't a place to sit. Now everyone's moved away.
This neighborhood is deemed uninhabitable. A coal mine lies just beneath the surface of the earth, and it's slowly swallowing the church. The altar has sunken below the back row of pews, and Zhang has nailed a portrait of Jesus atop a wide crack that snakes across the wall like a bolt of lightning. His world is caving in.
Once coal goes bust, Qitaihe's economy won't survive. After the mine shut down, many of us will be forced to move inside the wall.
People up here say inside the wall to refer to the populated part of China that lies south of the Great Wall. Zhangstown is in a region known as Manchuria. It's north of the wall, a place the Chinese used to consider remote, barren, and inhabited by savages. Pretty soon, says Zhang, hordes of miners with no jobs and no education will find their way south to the wealthier cities of Beijing, Shanghai, and beyond. They'll look for work, he says, and if they don't find it, they'll look for trouble. In Qitaihe, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the threat of global warming becomes just a little bit more real. A working paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research says that climate change, to quote the Bloomberg headline that I saw, kills the mood. The deal is this. Economists studied 80 years of fertility data, cross-indexed it with temperature data, and lo and behold, when there are more days than usual above 80 degrees, there is a drop in, and this is their quote, the economist's quote, not mine, there's a drop in coital frequency and thus a drop in births 9 or 10 months later. More to the point, even if it cools down, you never get those extra births back. Come on. Who said climate change policy wasn't sexy, huh? Who was that? All righty, got to go. The Dow up 89 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ up 17 points, a third percent. The S&P 500 up 5 points, about a quarter percent. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer around here is Nishant Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.